content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. With the recent release of the movie Oppenheimer, coinciding with the 78th anniversary of the nuclear attack on Japan by the U.S. on August 6, 1945, for the next 3 weeks, I will read Hiroshima by John Hersey, a first-hand account of the human impact on citizens of Hiroshima, published as the entire August 31, 1946 edition of the New Yorker magazine. Hersey was dispatched by the New Yorker to Hiroshima in May of 1946 to write an article describing the human impacts of the bomb. In plain, spare prose, Hersey documented scenes of unprecedented ruin and human suffering, capturing the ghostly residuum of calamity. Hersey organized his article around six survivors he interviewed in Hiroshima, ordinary Japanese with families, friends, and jobs just like Americans. Hersey writes that 100,000 people were killed by the atomic bomb, and these six were among the survivors, leaving them to still wonder why they lived when so many others died, or too busy or too weary or too badly hurt to care that they were the objects of the first great experiment in the use of atomic power, which no country except the United States, with its industrial know-how, its willingness to throw $2 billion gold dollars into an important wartime gamble, could possibly have developed. The August 31st, 1946 Hiroshima edition of the New Yorker sold out almost immediately on newsstands, with Albert Einstein even attempting to buy 1,000 copies. Later, serialized in newspapers across the country, Hersey's Hiroshima became the first human account of the attack for most Americans. To this day, it remains one of the most important works of journalism ever created. This week, I will read part two of Hiroshima by John Hersey. If you missed part one, go to the website, ncreadingservice.org, look under podcast, New Yorker Magazine. And now, Hiroshima by John Hersey, part two. The lot of Drs. Fujii, Kanda, and Machii, right after the explosion, and, as these three were typical, that of the majority of the physicians and surgeons of Hiroshima, with their offices and hospitals destroyed, their equipment scattered, their own bodies incapacitated in varying degrees, explained why so many citizens who were hurt went untended, and why so many who might have lived died. Of 150 doctors in the city, 65 were already dead, and most of the rest were wounded. Of 1,780 nurses, 1,654 were dead or too badly hurt to work. In the biggest hospital, that of the Red Cross, only 6 doctors out of 30 were able to function, and only 10 nurses out of more than 200. The sole uninjured doctor on the Red Cross hospital staff was Dr. Sasaki. After the explosion, he hurried to a storeroom to fetch bandages. This room, like everything he had seen as he ran through the hospital, was chaotic. Bottles of medicines thrown off shelves and broken, salves spattered on the walls, instruments strewn everywhere. He grabbed up some bandages and an unbroken bottle of mercurochrome, hurried back to the chief surgeon, and bandaged his cuts. Then he went out into the corridor and began patching up the wounded patients and the doctors and nurses there. He blundered so without his glasses that he took a pair off the face of a wounded nurse, and although they only approximately compensated for the errors of his vision, they were better than nothing. He was to depend on them for more than a month. Dr. Sasaki worked without method, taking those who were nearest him first, and he noticed soon that the corridor seemed to be getting more and more crowded. mixed in with the abrasions and lacerations which most people in the hospital had suffered. He began to find dreadful burns. He realized then that casualties were pouring in from outdoors. There were so many that he began to pass up the lightly wounded. He decided that all he could hope to do was to stop people from bleeding to death. Before long, patients lay and crouched on the floors of the wards and the laboratories and all the other rooms, and in the corridors and on the stairs and in the front hall and on the stone front steps and in the driveway and courtyard and for blocks each way in the streets outside. Wounded people supported maimed people. Disfigured families leaned together. Many people were vomiting. A tremendous number of schoolgirls, some of those who had been taken from their classrooms to work outdoors clearing fire lanes, crept into the hospital. In a city of 245,000, nearly 100,000 people had been killed or doomed at one blow. 100,000 more were hurt. At least 10,000 of the wounded made their way to the best hospital in town, which was altogether unequal to such a trampling, since it had only 600 beds, and they had all been occupied. The people in the suffocating crowd inside the hospital wept and cried for Dr. Sasaki to hear, "Sensei! Doctor!" And the less seriously wounded came and pulled at his sleeve and begged him to come to the aid of the worse wounded. Tugged here and there in his stockinged feet, bewildered by the numbers, staggered by so much raw flesh, Dr. Sasaki lost all sense of profession and stopped working as a skillful surgeon and a sympathetic man. He became an automaton, mechanically wiping, daubing, winding, wiping, daubing, winding. Some of the wounded in Hiroshima were unable to enjoy the questionable luxury of hospitalization. In what had been the personnel office of the East Asia Tin Works, Miss Sasaki lay doubled over, unconscious, under the tremendous pile of books and plaster and wood and corrugated iron. She was wholly unconscious. She later estimated for about 3 hours. Her first sensation was of dreadful pain in her left leg. It was so black under the books and debris that the borderline between awareness and unconsciousness was fine. She apparently crossed it several times, for the pain seemed to come and go. At the moments when it was sharpest, she felt that her leg had been cut off somewhere below the knee. Later, she heard someone walking on top of the wreckage above her, and anguished voices spoke up, evidently from within the mess around her. "Please help! Get us out!" Father Kleinsorge stemmed Father Schiffer's spurting cut as well as he could with some bandage that Dr. Fujii had given the priest a few days before. When he finished, he ran into the mission house again and found the jacket of his military uniform and an old pair of gray trousers. He put them on and went outside. A woman from next door ran up to him and shouted that her husband was buried under her house and the house was on fire. Father Kleinsorge must come and save him. Father Kleinsorge, already growing apathetic and dazed in the presence of the cumulative distress, said, "We haven't much time. Houses all around were burning, and the wind was now blowing hard. Do you know exactly which part of the house he is under?" he asked.
"Yes, yes," she said. "Come quickly."
They went around to the house, the remains of which blazed violently, but when they got there, it turned out that the woman had no idea where her husband was. Father Kleinsorge shouted several times, "Is there anyone here? Is there anyone there?" There was no answer. Father Kleinsorge said to the woman, "We must get away or we will all die." He went back to the Catholic compound and told the Father Superior that the fire was coming closer on the wind, which had swung around and was now from the north. It was time for everybody to go. Just then, the kindergarten teacher pointed out to the priest, Mr. Fukai, the secretary of the diocese, who was standing in his window on the second floor of the mission house, facing in the direction of the explosion, weeping. Father Sislik, because he thought the stairs unusable, ran around to the back of the mission house to look for a ladder. There, he heard people crying for help under a nearby fallen roof. He called to passers-by running away in the street to help him lift it, but nobody paid any attention, and he had to leave the buried ones to die. Father Kleinsorge ran inside the mission house and scrambled up the stairs, which were awry and piled with plaster and lathing, and called to Mr. Fukai from the doorway of his room. Mr. Fukai, a very short man of about 50, turned around slowly with a queer look and said, "Leave me here." Father Kleinsorge went into the room and took Mr. Fukai by the collar of his coat and said, "Come with me or you'll die." Mr. Fukai said, "Leave me here to die." Father Kleinsorge began to shove and haul Mr. Fukai out of the room. Then the theological student came up and grabbed Mr. Fukai's feet, and Father Kleinsorge took his shoulders, and together they carried him downstairs and outdoors. "I can't walk," Mr. Fukai cried. "Leave me here." Father Kleinsorge got his paper suitcase with the money in it and took Mr. Fukai up pickaback, and the party started for the East Parade Ground, their district's safe area. As they went out of the gate, Mr. Fukai, quite childlike now, beat on Father Kleinsorge's shoulders and said, "I won't leave, I won't leave." Irrelevantly, Father Kleinsorge turned to Father LaSalle and said, "We have lost all our possessions, but not our sense of humor." The street was cluttered with parts of houses that had slid into it and with fallen telephone poles and wires. From every second or third house came the voices of people buried and abandoned, who invariably screamed, with formal politeness, "Tasukete kure! Help, if you please!" The priest recognized several ruins from which these cries came as the homes of friends, but because of the fire, it was too late to help. All the way, Mr. Fukai whimpered, "Let me stay." The party turned right when they came to a block of fallen houses that was one flame. At Sakai Bridge, which would take them across to the East Parade Ground, they saw that the whole community on the opposite side of the river was a sheet of fire. They dared not cross and decided to take refuge in Asano Park, off to their left. Father Kleinsorge, who had been weakened for a couple of days by his bad case of diarrhea, began to stagger under his protesting burden. And as he tried to climb up over the wreckage of several houses that blocked their way to the park, he stumbled, dropped Mr. Fukai, and plunged down, head over heels, to the edge of the river. When he picked himself up, he saw Mr. Fukai running away. Father Kleinsorge shouted to a dozen soldiers who were standing by the bridge to stop him. As Father Kleinsorge started back to get Mr. Fukai, Father LaSalle called out, "Hurry, don't waste time!" So Father Kleinsorge just requested the soldiers to take care of Mr. Fukai. They said they would. But the little broken man got away from them, and the last the priest could see of him, he was running back toward the fire. Mr. Tanimoto, fearful for his family and church, at first ran toward them by the shortest route along Koi Highway. He was the only person making his way into the city. He met hundreds and hundreds who were fleeing, and every one of them seemed to be hurt in some way. The eyebrows of some were burned off and skin hung from their faces and hands. Others, because of pain, held their arms up as if carrying something in both hands. Some were vomiting as they walked. Many were naked or in shreds of clothing. On some undressed bodies, the burns had made patterns of undershirt straps and suspenders, and on the skin of some women, since white repelled the heat from the bomb and dark clothes absorbed it and conducted it to the skin, the shapes of flowers they had had on their kimonos. Many, although injured themselves, supported relatives who were worse off. Almost all had their heads bowed, looked straight ahead, were silent, and showed no expression whatever. After crossing Koi Bridge and Cannon Bridge, having run the whole way, Mr. Tanimoto saw, as he approached the center, that all the houses had been crushed and many were afire. Here the trees were bare and their trunks were charred. He tried at several points to penetrate the ruins, but the flames always stopped him. Under many houses, people screamed for help, but no one helped. In general, survivors that day assisted only their relatives or immediate neighbors, for they could not comprehend or tolerate a wider circle of misery. The wounded limped past the screams, and Mr. Tanimoto ran past them. As a Christian, he was filled with compassion for those who were trapped, and as a Japanese, he was overwhelmed by the shame of being unhurt, and he prayed as he ran, "God, help them and take them out of the fire." He thought he would skirt the fire to the left. He ran back to Cannon Bridge and followed for a distance one of the rivers. He tried several cross streets, but all were blocked. So he turned far left and ran out to Yokogawa, a station on a railroad line that detoured the city in a wide semicircle, and he followed the rails until he came to a burning train. So impressed was he by this time by the extent of the damage that he ran north 2 miles to Gion, a suburb in the foothills. All the way, he overtook dreadfully burned and lacerated people, and in his guilt, he turned to right and left as he hurried and said to some of them, "Excuse me for having no burden like yours." Near Gion, he began to meet country people going toward the city to help. And when they saw him, several exclaimed, "Look, there is one who is not wounded." At Gion, he bore toward the right bank of the main river, the Ota, and ran down it until he reached fire again. There was no fire on the other side of the river, so he threw off his shirt and shoes and plunged into it. In midstream, where the current was fairly strong, exhaustion and fear finally caught up with him. He had run nearly 7 miles, and he became limp and drifted in the water. He prayed, "Please, God, help me to cross. It would be nonsense for me to be drowned when I am the only uninjured one." He managed a few more strokes and fetched up on a spit downstream. Mr. Tanimoto climbed up the bank and ran along it until, near a large Shinto shrine, he came to more fire. And as he turned left to get around it, he met, by incredible luck, his wife. She was carrying their infant son. Mr. Tanimoto was now so emotionally worn out that nothing could surprise him. He did not embrace his wife. He simply said, "Oh, you are safe." She told him that she had got home from her night in Yoshida just in time for the explosion. She had been buried under the parsonage with the baby in her arms. She told how the wreckage had pressed down on her, how the baby had cried. She saw a chink of light, and by reaching up with a hand, she worked the hole bigger, bit by bit. After about half an hour, she heard the crackling noise of wood burning. At last, the opening was big enough for her to push the baby out, and afterwards she crawled out herself. She said she was now going out to Yoshida again. Mr. Tanimoto said he wanted to see his church and take care of the people of his neighborhood association. They parted as casually, as bewildered as they had met. Mr. Tanimoto's way around the fire took him across the East Parade Ground, which, being an evacuation area, was now the scene of a gruesome review, rank on rank of the burned and bleeding. Those who were burned moaned, "Mizu, Mizu, water, water." Mr. Tanimoto found a basin in a nearby street and located a water tap that still worked in the crushed shell of a house, and he began carrying water to the suffering strangers. When he had given drink to about 30 of them, he realized he was taking too much time. "Excuse me," he said loudly to those nearby who were reaching out their hands to him and crying their thirst. "I have many people to take care of." Then he ran away. He went to the river again, the basin in his hand, and jumped down onto a sand spit. There he saw hundreds of people so badly wounded that they could not get up to go farther from the burning city. When they saw a man erect and unhurt, the chant began again. Mizu! 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 Mr. Tanimoto could not resist them. He carried them water from the river. A mistake, since it was tidal and brackish. Two or three small boats were ferrying hurt people across the river from Asano Park. And when one touched the spit, Mr. Tanimoto again made his loud, apologetic speech and jumped into the boat. It took him across to the park. There, in the underbrush, he found some of his charges of the neighborhood association, who had come there by his previous instructions. And he saw many acquaintances, among them Father Kleinsorge and the other Catholics. But he missed Fukai, who had been a close friend. "Where is Fukai-san?" he asked. "He didn't want to come with us," Father Kleinsorge said. He ran back. When Miss Sasaki heard the voices of the people caught along with her in the dilapidation at the tin factory, she began speaking to them. Her nearest neighbor, she discovered, was a high school girl who had been drafted for factory work and who said her back was broken. Miss Sasaki replied, "I am lying here, and I can't move. My left leg is cut off." Sometime later, she again heard somebody walk overhead and then move off to one side, and whoever it was began burrowing. The digger released several people, and when he had uncovered the high school girl, she found that her back was not broken after all, and she crawled out. Miss Sasaki spoke to the rescuer, and he worked toward her. He pulled away a great number of books until he had made a tunnel to her. She could see his perspiring face as he said, "Come out, miss!" She tried. "I can't move," she said. The man excavated some more and told her to try with all her strength to get out. But books were heavy on her hips, and the man finally saw that a bookcase was leaning on the books and that a heavy beam pressed down on the bookcase. "Wait," he said, "I'll get a crowbar." The man was gone a long time, and when he came back, he was ill-tempered, as if her plight were all her fault. "We have no men to help you," he shouted in through the tunnel. "You'll have to get out by yourself."
"That's impossible," she said. "My left leg."
The man went away. Much later, several men came and dragged Miss Sasaki out. Her left leg was not severed, but it was badly broken and cut, and it hung askew below the knee. They took her out into a courtyard. It was raining. She sat on the ground in the rain. When the downpour increased, someone directed all the wounded people to take cover in the factory's air raid shelters.
"Come along,"
a torn-up woman said to her.
"You can hop."
But Miss Sasaki could not move, and she just waited in the rain. Then a man propped up a large sheet of corrugated iron as a kind of lean-to and took her in his arms and carried her to it. She was grateful until he brought two horribly wounded people. A woman with a whole breast sheared off, and a man whose face was all raw from a burn, to share the simple shed with her. No one came back. The rain cleared, and the cloudy afternoon was hot. Before nightfall, the three grotesques under the slanting piece of twisted iron began to smell quite bad. The former head of the Nobori Cho Neighborhood Association, to which the Catholic priest belonged, was an energetic man named Yoshida. He had boasted, when he was in charge of the district air raid defenses, that fire might eat away all of Hiroshima, but it would never come to Nobori-sho. The bomb blew down his house, and a joist pinned him by the legs, in full view of the Jesuit mission house across the way, and of the people hurrying along the street. In their confusion, as they hurried past, Mrs. Nakamura, with her children, and Father Kleinsorge, with Mr. Fukai on his back, hardly saw him. He was just part of the general blur of misery through which they moved. His cries for help brought no response from them. There were so many people shouting for help that they could not hear him separately. They and all the others went along. Noboricho became absolutely deserted, and the fire swept through it. Mr. Yoshida saw the wooden mission house, the only erect building in the area, go up in a lick of flame, and the heat was terrific on his face. The flames came along his side of the street and entered his house. In a paroxysm of terrified strength, he freed himself and ran down the alleys of Noboricho, hemmed in by the fire he had said would never come. He began at once to behave like an old man. 2 months later, his hair was white. As Dr. Fujii stood in the river up to his neck to avoid the heat of the fire, the wind grew stronger and stronger, and soon, even though the expanse of water was small, the waves grew so high that the people under the bridge could no longer keep their footing. Dr. Fujii went close to the shore, crouched down, and embraced a large stone with his usable arm. Later, it became possible to wade along the very edge of the river, and Dr. Fujii and his two surviving nurses moved about 200 yards upstream to a sand spit near Asano Park. Many wounded were lying on the sand. Dr. Machii was there with his family. His daughter, who had been outdoors when the bomb burst, was badly burned on her hands and legs, but fortunately not on her face. Although Dr. Fujii's shoulder was by now terribly painful, he examined the girl's burns curiously. Then he lay down. In spite of all the misery around, he was ashamed of his appearance, and he remarked to Dr. Machii that he looked like a beggar, dressed as he was in nothing but torn and bloody underwear. Late in the afternoon, when the fire began to subside, he decided to go to his parental house in the suburb of Nagatsuka. He asked Dr. Machii to join him, but the doctor answered that he and his family were going to spend the night on the spit because of his daughter's injuries. Dr. Fujii, together with his nurses, walked first to Ishida, where, in the partially damaged house of some relatives, he found first aid materials he had stored there. The two nurses bandaged him and he them. They went on. Now, not many people walked in the streets, but a great number sat and lay on the pavement, vomited, waited for death, and died. The number of corpses on the way to Nagatsuka was more and more puzzling. The doctor wondered, could a Molotov flower basket have done all this? Dr. Fujii reached his family's house in the evening. It was 5 miles from the center of town, but its roof had fallen in and the windows were all broken. All day, people poured into Asano Park. This private estate was far enough away from the explosion so that its bamboos, pines, laurel, and the maples were still alive, and the green place invited refugees. Partly because they believed that if the Americans came back, they would bomb only buildings. Partly because the foliage seemed a center of coolness and life, and the estate's exquisitely precise rock gardens, with their quiet pools and arching bridges, were very Japanese, normal, secure. And also partly, according to some who were there, because of an irresistible, atavistic urge to hide under leaves. Mrs. Nakamura and her children were among the first to arrive, and they settled in the bamboo grove near the river. They all felt terribly thirsty, and they drank from the river. At once they were nauseated and began vomiting, and they retched the whole day. Others were also nauseated. They all thought, probably because of the strong odor of ionization, an electric smell given off by the bomb's fission, that they were sick from a gas the Americans had dropped. When Father Kleinsorge and the other priests came into the park, nodding to their friends as they passed, the Nakamuras were all sick and prostrate. A woman named Iwasaki, who lived in the neighborhood of the mission and who was sitting near the Nakamuras, got up and asked the priest if she should stay where she was or go with them. Father Klein Sorge said, "I hardly know where the safest place is." She stayed there, and later in the day, though she had no visible wounds or burns, she died. The priest went farther along the river and settled down in some underbrush. Father LaSalle lay down and went right to sleep. The theological student, who was wearing slippers, had carried with him a bundle of clothes in which he had packed two pairs of leather shoes. When he sat down with the others, he found that the bundle had broken open and a couple of shoes had fallen out, and now he had only two left. He retraced his steps and found one right. When he rejoined the priest, he said, "It's funny, but things don't matter anymore. Yesterday my shoes were my most important possessions. Today, I don't care. One pair is enough." Father Sisolik said, "I know. I started to bring my books along, and then I thought, this is no time for books." When Mr. Tanimoto, with his basin still in his hand, reached the park, it was very crowded, and to distinguish the living from the dead was not easy, for most of the people lay still, with their eyes open. To Father Kleinsorge, an Occidental, the silence in the grove by the river, where hundreds of gruesomely wounded suffered together, was one of the most dreadful and awesome phenomena of his whole experience. The hurt ones were quiet. No one wept, much less screamed in pain. No one complained. None of the many who died did so noisily. Not even the children cried. Very few people even spoke. And when Father Kleinsorge gave water to some whose faces had been almost blotted out by flash burns, they took their share and then raised themselves a little and bowed to him in thanks. Mr. Tanimoto greeted the priest and then looked around for other friends. He saw Mrs. Matsumoto, wife of the director of the Methodist school, and asked her if she was thirsty. She was, so he went to one of the pools in the Asano's rock gardens and got water for her in his basin. Then he decided to try to get back to his church. He went into Naboricho by the way the priests had taken as they had escaped, but he did not get far. The fire along the streets was so fierce that he had to turn back. He walked to the riverbank and began to look for a boat in which he might carry some of the most severely injured across the river from Asano Park and away from the spreading fire. Soon, he found a good-sized pleasure punt drawn up on the bank, but in and around it was an awful tableau, five dead men, nearly naked, badly burned, who must have expired more or less all at once, for they were in attitudes which suggested that they had been working together to push the boat down into the river. Mr. Tanimoto lifted them away from the boat, and as he did so, he experienced such horror at disturbing the dead, preventing them, he momentarily felt, from launching their craft and going on their ghostly way, that he said out loud, "Please forgive me for taking this boat. I must use it for others who are alive." The punt was heavy, but he managed to slide it into the water. There were no oars, and all he could find for propulsion was a thick bamboo pole. He worked the boat upstream to the most crowded part of the park and began to ferry the wounded. He could pack 10 or 12 into the boat for each crossing, but as the river was too deep in the center to pole his way across, he had to paddle with the bamboo, and consequently each trip took a very long time. He worked several hours that way. Early in the afternoon, the fire swept into the woods of Asano Park. The first Mr. Tanimoto knew of it was when, returning in his boat, he saw that a great number of people had moved toward the riverside. On touching the bank, he went up to investigate. And when he saw the fire, he shouted, "All the young men who are not badly hurt, come with me!" Father Kleinsorger moved Father Schiffer and Father LaSalle close to the edge of the river and asked people there to get them across if the fire came too near, and then joined Tanimoto's volunteers. Mr. Tanimoto sent some to look for buckets and basins and told others to beat the burning underbrush with their clothes. When utensils were at hand, he formed a bucket chain from one of the pools in the rock gardens. The team fought the fire for more than 2 hours and gradually defeated the flames. As Mr. Tanimoto's men worked, the frightened people in the park pressed closer and closer to the river. And finally, the mob began to force some of the unfortunates who were on the very bank into the water. Among those driven into the river and drowned were Mrs. Matsumoto of the Methodist school and her daughter. When Father Kleinsorger got back after fighting the fire, he found Father Schiffer still bleeding and terribly pale. Some Japanese stood around and stared at him, and Father Schiffer whispered with a weak smile, "It's as if I were already dead." "Not yet," Father Kleinsorger said. He had brought Dr. Fujii's first aid kit with him, and he had noticed Dr. Kanda in the crowd, so he sought him out and asked him if he would dress Father Schiffer's bad cuts. Dr. Kanda had seen his wife and daughter dead in the ruins of his hospital. He sat now with his head in his hands. "I can't do anything," he said. Father Kleinsorger bound more bandage around Father Schiffer's head, moved him to a steep place, and settled him so that his head was high, and soon the bleeding diminished. The roar of approaching planes was heard about this time. Someone in the crowd near the Nakamura family shouted, "It's some Grumman's coming to strafe us!" A baker named Nakashima stood up and commanded, "Everyone who is wearing anything white, take it off!" Mrs. Nakamura took the blouses off her children and opened her umbrella and made them get under it. A great number of people, even badly burned ones, crawled into bushes and stayed there until the hum, evidently of a reconnaissance or weather run, died away. It began to rain. Mrs. Nakamura kept her children under the umbrella. The drops grew abnormally large and someone shouted, "The Americans are dropping gasoline! They're going to set fire to us!" This alarm stemmed from one of the theories being passed through the park as to why so much of Hiroshima had burned. It was that a single plane had sprayed gasoline on the city and then somehow set fire to it in one flashing moment. But the drops were palpably water, and as they fell, the wind grew stronger and stronger, and suddenly, probably because of the tremendous convection set up by the blazing city, a whirlwind ripped through the park. Huge trees crashed down. Small ones were uprooted and flew into the air. Higher, a wild array of flat things revolved in the twisting funnel. Pieces of iron roofing, papers, doors, strips of matting. Father Kleinsorger put a piece of cloth over Father Schiffer's eyes, so that the feeble man would not think he was going crazy. The gale blew Mrs. Murata, the mission housekeeper, who was sitting close by the river, down the embankment at a shallow, rocky place, and she came out with her bare feet bloody. The vortex moved out onto the river, where it sucked up a waterspout and eventually spent itself. After the storm, Mr. Tanimoto began ferrying people again, and Father Kleinsorger asked the theological student to go across and make his way out to the Jesuit novitiate at Nagatsuka, about 3 miles from the center of town, and to request the priest there to come with help for Father Schiffer and LaSalle. The student got into Mr. Tanimoto's boat and went off with him. Father Kleinsorger asked Mrs. Nakamura if she would like to go out to Nagatsuka with the priest when they came. She said she had some luggage and her children were sick. They were still vomiting from time to time. And so, for that matter, was she. And therefore she feared she could not. He said he thought the fathers from the novitiate could come back the next day with a pushcart to get her. Late in the afternoon, when he went ashore for a while, Mr. Tanimoto, upon whose energy and initiative many had come to depend, heard people begging for food. He consulted Father Kleinsorge, and they decided to go back into town to get some rice from Mr. Tanimoto's Neighborhood Association shelter and from the mission shelter. Father Sieslik and two or three others went with them. At first, when they got among the rows of prostrate houses, they did not know where they were. The change was too sudden, from a busy city of 245,000 that morning to a mere pattern of residue in the afternoon. The asphalt of the streets were still so soft and hot from the fires that walking was uncomfortable. They encountered only one person, a woman, who said to them as they passed, "My husband is in those ashes." At the mission, where Mr. Tanimoto left the party, Father Kleinsorge was dismayed to see the building raised. In the garden, on the way to the shelter, he noticed a pumpkin roasted on the vine. He and Father Sieslik tasted it, and it was good. They were surprised at their hunger, and they ate quite a bit. They got out several bags of rice and gathered up several other cooked pumpkins and dug up some potatoes that were nicely baked under the ground and started back. Mr. Tanimoto rejoined them on the way. One of the people with him had some cooking utensils. In the park, Mr. Tanimoto organized the lightly wounded women of his neighborhood to cook. Father Kleinsorge offered the Nakamura family some pumpkin, and they tried it, but they could not keep it on their stomachs. Altogether, the rice was enough to feed nearly 100 people. Just before dark, Mr. Tanimoto came across a 20-year-old girl, Mrs. Kamai, the Tanimoto's next-door neighbor. She was crouching on the ground with the body of her infant daughter in her arms. The baby had evidently been dead all day. Mrs. Kamai jumped up when she saw Mr. Tanimoto and said, "Would you please try to locate my husband?" Mr. Tanimoto knew that her husband had been inducted into the army just the day before. He and Mrs. Tanimoto had entertained Mrs. Kamai in the afternoon to make her forget. Kamai had reported to the Chogoku Regional Army headquarters near the ancient castle in the middle of town, where some 4,000 troops were stationed. Judging by the many maimed soldiers Mr. Tanimoto had seen during the day, he surmised that the barracks had been badly damaged by whatever it was that had hit Hiroshima. He knew he hadn't a chance of finding Mrs. Kamai's husband, even if he searched. But he wanted to humor her. "I'll try," he said.
"You've got to find him," she said. "He loved our baby so much. I want him to see her once more."
3. Details are being investigated. Early in the evening of the day the bomb exploded, a Japanese naval launch moved slowly up and down the seven rivers of Hiroshima. It stopped here and there to make an announcement, alongside the crowded sand pits on which hundreds of wounded lay, at the bridges on which others were crowded, and eventually, as twilight fell, opposite Asano Park. A young officer stood up in the launch and shouted through a megaphone, "Be patient! A naval hospital ship is coming to take care of you." The sight of the ship-shaped launch against the background of the havoc across the river, the unruffled young man in his neat uniform, above all, the promise of medical help, the first word of possible succor anyone had heard in nearly 12 awful hours, cheered the people in the park tremendously. Mrs. Nakamura settled her family for the night with the assurance that a doctor would come and stop their retching. Mr. Tanimoto resumed ferrying the wounded across the river. Father Kleinsorge lay down and said the Lord's Prayer and a Hail Mary to himself and fell right asleep. But no sooner had he dropped off than Mrs. Murata, the conscientious mission housekeeper, shook him and said, "Father Kleinsorge, do you remember to repeat your evening prayers?" He answered rather grumpily, "Of course," and he tried to go back to sleep but could not. This, apparently, was just what Mrs. Murata wanted. She began to chat with the exhausted priest. One of the questions she raised was when he thought the priests from the novitiate for whom he had sent a messenger in mid-afternoon, would arrive to evacuate Father Superior LaSalle and Father Schiffer. The messenger Father Kleinsorge had sent, the theological student who had been living at the mission house, had arrived at the novitiate in the hills about 3 miles out at 4:30. The 16 priests there had been doing rescue work in the outskirts. They had worried about their colleagues in the city, but had not known how or where to look for them. Now they hastily made 2 litters out of poles and boards, and the student led 6 of them back into the devastated area. They worked their way along the Ota above the city. Twice the heat of the fire forced them into the river. At Misasa Bridge, they encountered a long line of soldiers making a bizarre forced march away from the Chugoku Regional Army headquarters in the center of the town. All were grotesquely burned, and they supported themselves with staves or leaned on one another. Sick, burned horses hanging their heads stood on the bridge. When the rescue party reached the park, it was after dark, and progress was made extremely difficult by the tangle of fallen trees of all sizes that had been knocked down by the whirlwind that afternoon. At last, not long after Mrs. Murata asked her question, they reached their friends and gave them wine and strong tea. The priests discussed how to get Father Schiffer and Father LaSalle out to the novitiate. They were afraid that blundering through the park with them would jar them too much on the wooden litters, and that the wounded men would lose too much blood. Father Kleinsorge thought of Mr. Tanimoto and his boat, and called out to him on the river. When Mr. Tanimoto reached the bank, he said he would be glad to take the injured priest and their bearers upstream to where they could find a clear roadway. The rescuers put Father Schiffer onto one of the stretchers and lowered it into the boat, and 2 of them went aboard. Mr. Tanimoto, who still had no oars, pulled the punt upstream. About 30 minutes later, Mr. Tanimoto came back and excitedly asked the remaining priest to help him rescue 2 children he had seen standing up to their shoulders in the river. A group went out and picked them up, 2 young girls who had lost their family and were both badly burned. The priest stretched them on the ground next to Father Kleinsorge and then embarked Father LaSalle. Father Sislik thought he could make it out to the novitiate on foot, so he went aboard with the others. Father Kleinsorge was too feeble. He decided to wait in the park until the next day. He asked the men to come back with a handcart so that they could take Mrs. Nakamura and her 6 children to the novitiate. Mr. Tanimoto shoved off again. As the boatload of priests moved slowly upstream, they heard weak cries for help. A woman's voice stood out especially. "There are people here about to be drowned. Help us! The water is rising!" The sounds came from one of the sand spits, and those in the punt could see. In the reflected light of the still-burning fires, a number of wounded people lying at the edge of the river, already partly covered by the flooding tide. Mr. Tanimoto wanted to help them, but the priests were afraid that Father Schiffer would die if they didn't hurry, and they urged their ferryman along. He dropped them where he had put Father Schiffer down and then started back alone toward the sandspit. The night was hot, and it seemed even hotter because of the fires against the sky. But the younger of the 2 girls Mr. Tanimoto and the priest had rescued complained to Father Kleinsorge that she was cold. He covered her with his jacket. She and her older sister had been in the salt water of the river for 2 hours before being rescued. The younger one had huge, raw flash burns on her body. The salt water must have been excruciatingly painful to her. She began to shiver heavily and again said it was cold. Father Kleinsorge borrowed a blanket from someone nearby and wrapped her up. But she shook more and more and said again, "I am so cold." And then she suddenly stopped shivering and was dead. Mr. Tanimoto found about 20 men and women on the sandspit. He drove the boat onto the bank and urged them to get aboard. They did not move, and he realized that they were too weak to lift themselves. He reached down and took a woman by the hands, but her skin slipped off in huge, glove-like pieces. He was so sickened by this that he had to sit down for a moment. Then he got out into the water, and, though a small man, lifted several of the men and women who were naked into his boat. Their backs and breasts were clammy, and he remembered uneasily what the great burns he had seen during the day had been like, yellow at first, then red and swollen, with the skin sloughed off, and finally, in the evening, suppurated and smelly. With the tide risen, his bamboo pole was now too short, and he had to paddle most of the way across with it. On the other side, at a higher spit, he lifted the slimy living bodies out and carried them up the slope away from the tide. He had to keep consciously repeating to himself, "These are human beings." It took him 3 trips to get them all across the river. When he had finished, he decided he had to have a rest, and he went back to the park. As Mr. Tanimoto stepped up the dark bank, he tripped over someone, and someone else said angrily, "Look out, that's my hand!" Mr. Tanimoto, ashamed of hurting wounded people, embarrassed at being able to walk upright, suddenly thought of the naval hospital ship, which had not come. It never did. And he had for a moment a feeling of blind, murderous rage at the crew of the ship, and then at all doctors. Why didn't they come to help these people? Dr. Fujii lay in dreadful pain throughout the night on the floor of his family's roofless house on the edge of the city. By the light of the lantern, he had examined himself and found, left clavicle fractured, multiple abrasions and lacerations of face and body, including deep cuts on the chin, back, and legs, extensive contusions on chest and trunk, a couple of ribs possibly fractured. Had he not been so badly hurt, he might have been at Asano Park, assisting the wounded. By nightfall, 10,000 victims of the explosion had invaded the Red Cross Hospital, and Dr. Sasaki, worn out, was moving aimlessly and dully up and down the stinking corridors with wads of bandages and bottles of mercurochrome, still wearing the glasses he had taken from the wounded nurse, binding up the worst cuts as he came to them. Other doctors were putting compresses of saline solution on the worst burns. That was all they could do. After dark, they worked by the light of the city's fires and by candles the 10 remaining nurses held for them. Dr. Sasaki had not looked outside the hospital all day. The scene inside was so terrible and so compelling that it had not occurred to him to ask any questions about what had happened beyond the windows and the doors. Ceilings and partitions had fallen. Plaster, dust, blood, and vomit were everywhere. Patients were dying by the hundreds, but there was nobody to carry away the corpses. Some of the hospital staff distributed biscuits and rice balls, but the charnel house smell was so strong that few were hungry. By 3 o'clock the next morning, after 19 straight hours of this gruesome work, Dr. Sasaki was incapable of dressing another wound. He and some other survivors of the hospital staff got straw mats and went outdoors. Thousands of patients and hundreds of dead were in the yard and on the driveway, and hurried around behind the hospital and lay down in hiding to snatch some sleep. But within an hour, wounded people had found them. A complaining circle formed around them.
"Doctors, help us. How can you sleep?"
Dr. Sasaki got up again and went back to work. Early in the day, he thought for the first time of his mother at their country home in Mukaihara, 30 miles from town. He usually went home every night. He was afraid she would think he was dead. Near the spot upriver to which Mr. Tanimoto had transported the priests, there sat a large case of rice cakes which a rescue party had evidently brought for the wounded lying thereabouts, but hadn't distributed. Before evacuating the wounded priests, the others passed the cakes around and helped themselves. A few minutes later, a band of soldiers came up, and an officer, hearing the priests speaking a foreign language, drew his sword and hysterically asked who they were. One of the priests calmed him down and explained that they were Germans, allies. The officer apologized and said that there were reports going around that American parachutists had landed. The priest decided that they should take Father Schiffer first. As they prepared to leave, Father Superior LaSalle said he felt awfully cold. One of the Jesuits gave up his coat, another his shirt. They were glad to wear less in the muggy night. The stretcher bearers started out. The theological student led the way and tried to warn the others of obstacles. But one of the priests got a foot tangled in some telephone wire and tripped and dropped his corner of the litter. Father Schiffer rolled off, lost consciousness, came to, and then vomited. The bearers picked him up and went on with him to the edge of the city, where they had arranged to meet a relay of other priests, left him with them, and turned back and got the Father Superior. The wooden litter must have been terribly painful for Father LaSalle, in whose back scores of tiny particles of window glass were embedded. Near the edge of town, the group had to walk around an automobile burned and squatting on the narrow road, and the bearers on one side, unable to see their way in the darkness, fell into a deep ditch. Father LaSalle was thrown onto the ground, and the litter broke in two. One priest went ahead to get a handcart from the novitiate, but he soon found one beside an empty house and wheeled it back. The priest lifted Father LaSalle into the cart and pushed him over the bumpy road the rest of the way. The rector of the novitiate, who had been a doctor before he entered the religious order, cleaned the wounds of the two priests and put them to bed between clean sheets, and they thanked God for the care they had received. Thousands of people had nobody to help them. Miss Sasaki was one of them. Abandoned and helpless, under the crude lean-to in the courtyard of the tin factory, beside the woman who had lost a breast and the man whose burned face was scarcely a face anymore. She suffered awfully that night from the pain in her broken leg. She did not sleep at all. Neither did she converse with her sleepless companion.
We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time for part 3 of Hiroshima by John Hersey. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.